Keys, Installment 3, Transition. Critical thinking question, why do so many people, unfortunately almost all people, support and believe in the public schools? Well, you might be saying, because they were educated in the public schools, so they just learned to be sort of attracted to things that are really expensive and inefficient and violent? Yeah, I think you're right. But the answer might even be a little bit more complicated than that. And that answer might contain some valuable clues that could be very useful to people like us and for our goals in the future. The people calling themselves government have a monopoly over the service of education in this country. As is the case in most, if not all, so-called countries on this planet. Now, when I say that, many people will quickly offer up the rebuttal that that's not true because there are private schools and alternative schools and in most places, people have the option of homeschooling, and, you know, that's pretty true. But I think even if I got into a discussion about, well, you know, private school isn't really private, and then I could talk about my own experiences of how monitored and regulated and controlled and supervised it is by the state, or then, you know, homeschooling doesn't really offer as much freedom in many places as people are led to believe. We talked on an earlier show about the parents who were arrested for failing to submit the proper paperwork to their state supervisors. But both of those arguments kind of miss the point here. Because what I'm driving at, I think, is this. Here's a good way to explain it. In any neighborhood that's controlled by the mafia has a monopoly over the service of protection in that neighborhood. A couple of mobsters go into, you know, a local business, and they approach the owner or the shopkeeper, and they say, hey, buddy, you know, for $300 a week, we can make sure nothing bad happens here. Kind of with the subtle but very, very clear subtext that if you don't give us $300 a week, something bad will happen here. But maybe if the owner or the shopkeeper doesn't pick this up, he might respond with something like, well, that's okay. I keep a gun under the counter here, and I've got a security system, and we even set up a neighborhood watch. To which the mob responds, well, you know, that's really great that you have those options, but why don't you just go ahead and plan to give us $300 a week because we really want to be certain that nothing bad, nothing terrible, you know, broken windows, damaged merchandise, God forbid broken bones, something just completely unforeseen goes on in this wonderful establishment of yours. So we'll be here on Friday every week to collect $300. That's a monopoly on protection. Doesn't matter if you are using the so-called service, you're going to pay for it. And it works exactly the same way with government education. You don't have to send your children to the government schools, but you're going to pay for it. Whether you use the service or not, you are going to fund it. For people like me, this is obviously kind of a major obstacle in as we sort of look down the long and winding path towards the abolition of government school in America, or hopefully, you know, everywhere eventually. Because that's like a difficult problem to get around. Now, to many, I think that this problem seems pretty insurmountable, that the government education system can just continue to suck up money no matter what. So in thinking about this, I was actually reminded of a news story. It actually became a major national news story. It was started with a pact about a year and a half ago between, I think, like 12 to 15 high school girls in Gloucester, Massachusetts, that they would all try to get pregnant at the same time. So just this, you know, thing that has become so common, teenage or high school age student pregnancy, becomes a national news story because it happened to 10 people all at the same time. So I just would want to, like, throw out the question, and sometimes I like to throw out questions to see what I would get back from listeners or people who have ideas about this. How many parents would need to make a decision collectively? I hate to use that word, but how large of a group of parents would need to make a decision to simultaneously take their children out of government school all at once to create a stir? So then, kind of as my head ascends further into the clouds, I wonder what would happen if in a relatively concentrated area, like 20% of parents, maybe like within a district, or even 10% of parents in a district pulled their kids out of the school. Could the school still justify their budgets if one out of every 10 kids left with the explanation that they just weren't getting an education there? It's an interesting question. Unfortunately, I think the answer would be yes, they could still justify their budgets, and their budgets would go up. Because they're very good at spinning failure into more funding. They could say something like, well, clearly what's happening here is that parents are feeling like their children can't get the kind of individuated attention or approaches to their learning that they really need. And this is not something that we can deliver in the public schools right now until we get, I don't know, a couple billion more dollars. Because then if we had, like, it's just an issue of money. If we had $2 billion more dollars, we could solve that problem. But I think it's interesting to start asking these questions, to start thinking about these things. It's very, very difficult to imagine the transition from where we are to where I'd like to be. But this show is really about recognizing where we actually are. Over 90% of people in government schools, a system that's eating up $600 billion a year. And kind of dealing with that reality and starting to think about maybe even some practical ways to start working to change this. The other thing that should be pointed out is how our philosophy right now, just to establish where we are right now, to show people who might not be aware how serious of a dark place we really are when it comes to most people's attitudes about what education is and what education should be. I wanted to play a clip from a radio talk show, but they might do most of their work online. It's a left-wing show, so I'm sure they're very, very concerned with the rights of children and civil liberties and all of the left-wing talking points. The show's called The Young Turks, and they did a pretty in-depth expose, and I'm being completely sarcastic there, on the idea of unschooling and looking at families who do unschooling. Now, they actually pull a Good Morning America story that they just kind of piggyback their story on top of. But I thought this would be an interesting thing to start the show with, just to really, really illustrate where conventional wisdom is on education in America in 2010. So here we go.
Good Morning America did this really interesting piece on something known as unschooling. Okay, now...
Nice tone of voice. Way to poison the well.
Obama's administration is trying to reform education, but some parents are opting out of formal education altogether.
Wow, sounds like some parents should be more grateful to President Obama for his efforts.
They're not homeschooling their kids, they're unschooling their kids. Now, what unschooling is they allow their children to set their own educational pace. Mm. So they don't force them to learn anything. The
children
get to learn whatever they feel like they should learn. Okay, so basically it's giving all the power to the child when it comes to their education. Now, we have a video on this. Good Morning America did a great video on it. Let's watch it.
It's actually a total hit piece, but they do a good job making it sound objective.
And let me tell you something. I've got strong opinions on this when we come back. Let's watch.
The host of the show is...
Let a child follow his or own passions, and the learning will come from the doing. But most educators say there is often a huge gap between the utopian ideal and reality.
Oh, whoa. Let's pause it right there. I'm interested in learning a little bit more about how that supposed fact was introduced into this story. With the very authoritative statement, most educators say. Well, who are these educators and what exactly did they say? And since most educators are public school bureaucrats or university intellectuals, is it safe to say that there might be some kind of conflict of interest here, that they might... have a negative opinion about unschooling, because if it ever caught on, it would threaten their livelihood? Let's continue.
Imagine a world without school.
Here they show the kids running around and hitting each other with foam sticks.
For
it it looks like
kids,
pandemonium.
It's a reality. They're at home, not being homeschooled. They're being unschooled. We're talking about no textbooks, no tests, no formal education at all.
Over here, we're growing some pickles.
Living your life as if the school system didn't exist.
They'll never get X plus Y equals Z.
No.
They'll never get X plus Y equals Z. That's an algebra problem that could never be solved. Not for a number anyway, not with three variables.
Kids doing whatever they want.
That sounds incredibly frustrating.
They might watch television, they might play games on computers.
I wouldn't want to make a kid do that. But go on.
I know my kids, if they have a choice. Do you ever worry, though, about raising your kids so far out of the mainstream that they... will be handicapped in some way?
The way they learn, growing up is different than what most other people do. But in all other aspects, they're living in the mainstream.
They have experiences and knowledge that other people don't.
Now, yeah. The reaction to this has been intense, and everyone keeps asking, is this legal? Well, unschoolers typically register as homeschoolers.
I love that.
And we
is
have
this
a map
legal?
Here that shows that each
Could
state
something so
handles
insane
it
be legal?
Some have virtually no oversight. Others, like Colorado, for example, require either testing or evaluation every other year. And parents are all supposed to check in once a year with
this
curriculum.
Is,
but I'm telling
George
you,
Stephanopoulos.
Basically, they're
so
on
then
their
they cut
own
back
to study
the young
whatever
Turks.
They want.
Wow. Do you have any sense of how many families are actually trying this?
It's a growing number.
That's good enough. Okay, now here's the deal, right? If somebody says to me, hey, you know what, I have less rules because I want the kids to have creativity, freedom, etc. So I let them go to sleep whenever they want, okay? And I'm not mental about their chores and stuff. No problem. How about it, Hoss? Mm-hmm. Okay, if you think the kids are magically going to learn algebra out of the thin
X plus
air,
Y equals Z. I learned that from Good Morning America.
I mean, I don't know what to call you. Let's be kind and say you're deluding yourself. Well, she's... How's she going to learn chemistry? Well, you know, golly gee willikers, I was just playing Wii all day, and I decided, why not
right,
learn chemistry?
Right, because we have to be checking things off okay. the standards
yeah.
that the state
what
sets for these children.
That? Okay, come on, please. This is absurd. Right, it's easy to unschool them, but it's not easy to unclown them later when they're 18 years old. They're like, I don't know anything. What do you know about biology? Nothing. Physics? Nothing. You know, name it. History. What do you know about history? Nothing. I was unschooled. Well, then what does that make you? It doesn't make you stupid. That's not, you know, of course not. It does make you ignorant, though.
Absolutely. No, you make a great point. And look, I already wrote
about
this.
You didn't make a point at all.
Examiner, right? And I got a ton of comments from people who are like, no, homeschooling is right. This is completely different from homeschooling, okay? This is not providing any direction for your children whatsoever, thinking that they will, out of their own natural curiosity, seek knowledge. It doesn't work that way. When I was 10 years old, you know what I wanted to do? I wanted to watch the Power Rangers all day.
You're retarded.
That's what I wanted to do. I wasn't going to go and read about history. I wasn't going to brush up on my grammar. It doesn't work that way.
When I was young, the only question I wanted to answer was, what you going to do when Hulkamania comes down on you?
You're retarded.
Okay, you think I would have been like, oh, yeah, geometry. Can I please learn a little bit of geometry? I mean, how the hell are they ever going to catch up?
Catch up to
who? And you say,
who?
Okay, they're not going to catch up, but you're damning your kids to certain careers. I don't know if they've thought that through, too. Because they can't be mathematicians, they can't be scientists, they can't be professors. I mean, there's 108 things they can't be Now you say, all right, choose among the careers where you don't have to know anything.
Host the Young Turk.
Doing your kids a lot of damage. Don't do that. Look, I don't agree with homeschooling, but that's just a personal choice, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's, you can obviously disagree on that. But this unschooling is a terrible idea. I mean, that girl has no idea what's going on in the world. She said, oh, if I want to go to college, I'll just pick up a textbook. Yeah, good luck with that. How about you have to pick up 28 and learn them all right away? What are you going to do with the SATs? What are you going to do when you get to college and they say, all right, here's a physics class?
They never said that to me in college, maybe because I wasn't a science major.
They are growing pickles, so they know how to grow pickles.
Oh, good point. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Well, in case you need a pickle, they're your go-to people. Okay, so the number of career options open to you are work at McDonald's and be a pickle farmer.
Nice jab there at the end by the liberal who cares so much about people's civil liberties, making fun of somebody for their own personal choices. And there you go, folks. That's just about the best argument I've ever heard against unschooling. But you don't need to be able to make an argument to deride something that is unconventional, right? Because all the support goes to the thing that is conventional. That's what's normal. That's what people do. And, of course, in the media, look how much they benefit from people not being able to think. The Young Turks is incredibly successful. And, you know, of course, the other major obstacle, too, is that most people are entirely unaware. They have never even considered these harsh realities about government school that we talk about on this show all the time. This is not common knowledge at all. Most people, especially liberals like the Young Turks, think that government education is a great thing. As long as it's, you know, as long as it's run by the right people. Everything based on force is good as long as you have the right responsible people in charge of it. But those are the obstacles that we face. The weirdness of homeschooling or unschooling combined with the lack of knowledge, that most people have about the reality of government education combined with the Leviathan that is the government itself and their school system. So, the drive of this show is, first of all, to continue what School Sucks Podcast is all about, to spread information about government school. But also today, I want to put a spotlight on a person who, in New Hampshire, has taken some pretty big career risks, I would say, to try to offer people non-government solutions to public education. And I think that the more people who step up and try to do this, the more options become available, the more these ideas will enter into the mainstream, and the better chance we have of kind of getting somewhere with all this. So thank you very much for listening to School Sucks Podcast. If you haven't seen our new website yet, please do it. Once you get there, there's a register button at the top. You can create a profile. You can put in a picture, a website, some biographical information. You can jump in our forums. And I'm really grateful that so many people have already done that. The forums are active. Always would love to have more people in there sharing ideas. But thanks to everybody who's done that, and thanks to everybody who has contributed to the show as well. Thanks to Jason Osborne, the show's primary sponsor out in Defiance, Ohio. This discussion coming up is kind of a long one, so I'll leave it right there. Thank you for listening, and take care. My guest today is Kate Richard. She is the vice chairman and treasurer of the Board of Trustees at the Scholars Academy in Hooksett, New Hampshire. A school, a small private school for gifted students age 5 to 12. As we were just talking about, Kate, even though those are what people traditionally call elementary school ages, the school has no grades.
That's correct.
And it's ungraded.
Can you tell us a little bit of background about the Scholars Academy and how you came to be involved with it?
Sure. I had a parent support group in Manchester, New Hampshire. For parents of gifted children. Gifted children traditionally in public schools are underserved or ignored, so to speak. So these parents generally have a difficult time with the schools, and I kept hearing question after question from parents, are there any good schools in the area for gifted kids? I kept having to answer no. After about 10 or 15 no's, I realized that there was an opportunity, and I started to discuss with the people in the group starting a private school, you know, for these kids specifically, that they were asking me if there was a good school for. And that was about 2 years ago. It's taken us about 2 years to get where we are today, to having a location and actual employees and students and whatnot. So that's kind of where it came from.
I think that that's interesting, too. An interesting concept in what is called education today in America, that somebody would recognize a need or a demand and set out to satisfy that demand. I think that that's really something. It seems so unorthodox.
It was pretty ambitious, actually. Starting a school with a group of parents has been an adventure, I'll say that, and definitely ambitious. But now that I've done it, and this group of parents have done it, I think that with the right people involved, it's really possible for any group of parents to start their own school.
Yeah, and speaking of ambitious, I'm guessing that you're kind of looking at a bigger picture here as well. So when you see the success of what you've been able to do so far right here in the Manchester, New Hampshire area, what is your vision for the future? Not so much maybe the broader picture, but just for you, like what would you like to do next, or what are you looking to? How are you looking to expand, if at all?
On a personal level, I think that now that I have this background and experience, that I would enjoy continually working with groups of parents to start other small schools, whatever, elementary, you know, high school schools, any type of school that people are interested in, really, that they want for their kids. I think that, you know, every child is different and families have different needs. You know, some people choose to homeschool and can do that. Some people send their kids to Catholic school. And, you know, people make so many different choices that I think it would be, I say fun in an adventurous sort of way, to continue to help groups of parents start schools of their own. And then keep so that the schools stay small and they're engaged, you know, small communities, which for me, I feel like is a much better educational arena, so to speak, you know, for the kids.
Indeed. And, you know, I used the word, and we talked about it before we started recording today, too. I used the word gifted, and I'm always quick to point out that a 5-year-old child or a 3 or 4-year-old child or, you know, somebody who hasn't gone into the traditional schooling process certainly has, you know, plenty of natural gifts that sort of set them on a trajectory to being really well educated and really satisfied with themselves as far as, you know, their own personal learning experience or their own personal enlightenment is concerned. So even though I used that word gifted, I think it's important to point out that it's not, as I've mentioned several times before, it's not a select group of children who have this, you know, these tools, these natural attributes like the curiosity, the individuality, the creativity that really can propel someone to the next phase in their development and their learning based on, you know, what they need and want for themselves. But, you know, you're right. I think when kids are classified in the government school system as being above ability-wise their peers, they are hustled to the back of the class and given a book or given something separate to do, but effectively ignored. Those abilities that are coming through a little bit more in those children are not nurtured or even really encouraged in any way in the government schools. And I think that, you know, a lot of parents who've identified these things would want something else for their child when they see how that school environment actually works. So,
well, you know what? I have a tendency to look to kind of unschoolers as the perfect example of natural students. And so, yes, I have designed a school here, and it is a building, and, you know, there are teachers in it and students in it. But philosophically, my perspective is look at unschoolers as an example of that natural progression, that natural learning, that excitement for learning. And, you know, you may find, for example, I know unschoolers that have always been self-taught and self-driven. And therefore, you know, at least I have looked at that as an example of utilizing some of those, I guess, philosophically, that idea in the school. You know, our school at least has been set up to be, you know, completely individualized around the student and project based, you know, so it's not a traditional kind of curriculum where you would take a child and give them a book. Of course, it is a school for the gifted, so you have to remember that, you know, these children do have a tendency to be a fast learner. Mm-hmm. And so a traditional curriculum really doesn't work for them at all.
Right. Absolutely. No. And, you know, the other thing, too, as far as the unschooling, when we, like you and I have talked before about the philosophy, I don't want to call it a philosophy of education. I'm not even sure that education is the right word. A philosophy of learning. This philosophy of learning unschooling, and I haven't talked about it on the show enough yet, and I plan to do so quite a bit more in the future. But I think that it would be, you know, difficult to sell most parents on this idea when we look at the norms or the conventions of society as far as schooling or education is concerned. This is a radical departure from what most people would even consider. So if you're taking that philosophy and you're putting it into an environment where the parents who are going to pay you feel more comfortable, it would be a hard sell to say.
It does have to be modified, yeah, a little bit, because, you know, although I've spent a lot of time in my board meetings sharing information about the way children learn, mm-hmm, with the individuals who have formed this school with me. And many times, you know, my co-board members, the trustees, will look at me and say, wow, I never thought of that. That makes so much sense. So, you know, I think there's at least this school in particular has a happy medium in that some of the parents prefer their children to have a little bit more structure and a little more guidance, and others are looking for a more flexible environment. And because the school is individualized, it's based around each student, then that's completely possible.
Yeah, and I think that it's an interesting idea for the very reason, like I was saying, it would be a tough sell to present the idea of unschooling, which is just such a dramatic departure to most people as far as what is considered conventional. And before we started today, you said to me, I wrote down the quote, I put quotes around it and your name after it, people invest in things that exist. And
they
I
do.
Think that, you know, and it's not just, I know, you know, obviously.
I just got another, you know, I have my phone, gets my email, yeah, and I just got another email that I did get just another contribution to the school from someone that I don't even know in Raymond, New Hampshire. So, you know, people do, it is great. People do invest in things that are tangible.
Absolutely.
They want to see what they're, and especially parents and children. I mean, parents want to see what are they getting? What are they buying? They really care. I mean, people care about their kids. That's their top priority. And most, I mean, every family I know, their kids are their top priority, and they want to know, you know, what am I getting for my tuition dollars? That's for sure.
Yeah. And it's obviously, which is, you know, very important to what you're doing and to the larger picture of some kind of gradual, I mean, hopefully somewhat rapid, but it's the reality is it's probably going to be a pretty gradual transition away from the standard public school system that we have today. Is not only are people willing to invest in it financially, but also, you know, emotionally, and give it some credibility. If it's already there, if it's already functioning, then I think that people are far more willing to take it seriously and to consider it seriously than something that would be presented as more of an abstract idea. Now, this doesn't mean that I wouldn't want to see, you know, every child in everywhere completely in charge of their own education and self-directed and doing pretty much what we call unschooling. But I think it's very important that, as you and I have both, you know, kind of embraced and support the idea of unschooling, me especially on the show, I forget that over 90% of children in this country right now are in the government schools, and there's probably going to have to be a number of things that close that gap over time.
Well, and I feel really proud that I've created a solution to that problem on a very small scale. You know, I've created a place where kids can go to school, and it's non-government.
Right.
And so I feel really proud about that, you know, on so many different levels. You know, I mean, yes, I have a specific interest in gifted children, and I also have a specific interest in, you know, our human society. So, you know, in that vein, I feel really good about it.
You know, it kind of reminds me of the work I do. My story was, it was many years ago, I was kind of on my way to get certified to be a public school teacher. And then, you know, over time, I gradually started to realize more and more of the, you know, the reality of the school system. And, you know, my path has changed several times since then, just saying, oh, well, you know, I'll teach in private school if public school's so bad. Mm-hmm. And, you know, private school, the kind of private school that I was teaching in still had, you know, a real authoritarian top-down environment, strict discipline, very, very much, you know, controlled curriculum, controlled half hour by half hour activities and predictability, and it was not individuated in any way. And I eventually was driven out of that into like working with people in very small groups or one-on-one. But in many ways, I still find that even through what I'm doing, in a lot of ways, I'm kind of at the mercy of the school system with a lot of people that I work with. So yeah, I think that what you've done is really terrific. And now, I assume, and I hope I'm wrong, but I assume that there is some state agency that expects you to answer to them?
Well, kind of. We did have to get approved by the New Hampshire Department of Education. There were some flaming hoops to jump through. Yeah, yeah. Don't worry. It's fun.
Yeah. Oh, well, I've been there and done that, and I've seen.
But again, now I know how to negotiate it. So another group of parents comes along, I'm there. You know, I can call up the people at the New Hampshire Department of Ed, and they even know who I am. So I feel comfortable negotiating the system. I think it's worth it for where we're at, you know, in general. I think that, you know, funny, I was thinking to myself earlier, you know, your podcast is called School Sucks, and I kind of wanted my theme to be like, not all schools suck,
right?
You know, because I really think, again, you know, you were in that school where they were emulating the traditional curriculum. But when you have a school started by a small group of parents and it stays small, you really can stay away from that.
Mm-hmm.
It really is fairly easy to stay away from a traditional curriculum. I mean, when you only have 10 students and they're all different ages, you know, direct instruction doesn't work.
Right. You know, it was really for me where that is sort of kind of a big umbrella that, you know, school sucks. Now, obviously,
my school doesn't suck, Brett.
we're hearing that phrase towards, you know, the way that most students use it who are in public school, and that's such a common slogan there. But, you know, I realize that it's pretty true about most private schools. I work with plenty of private school kids as well. It's not that much of a different experience. And, you know, I even started the reason why I bring that up is because even when I really started to look closely at, like, the Sudbury model,
Which, you know, I like the Sudbury.
And I like a lot of things about the Sudbury model as well, because it is very, very learner driven. And there's actually a decent movie. It's a low budget movie, but it gives a pretty good look at a Sudbury like school. It's called Schooled, about a public school teacher who has to he gets himself in some trouble at the public school, and he escapes off somewhere else, and he kind of observes firsthand this alternative setting, and he's really just kind of shocked by what he sees. But it's a movie worth checking out if somebody wanted to learn a little bit more about what a Sudbury environment looks like. The only problem that I really had with Sudbury was the sort of democratic model, and you and I talked about this before as well, the democratic model for the functioning of the school.
I think that could be modified, though, with the right group of people involved,
I
don't
think
you?
So too. Well, see, that was the real question that I had. Could you have an institution where there are decisions, and important decisions, that need to be made collectively? I don't know. It's just like it's a tough way. It's tough for me to figure out how that would work. And my only apprehension about the Sudbury model is that the people who go to Sudbury schools would see that, you know, for a small group of people, a sort of democratic system can work in some respects some of the time. Like if
doesn't that apply to everything?
Yeah, well,
though?
You know, if five people are you know, planning to go out to dinner, I just said this at UConn. If, you know, I'm with five friends and four of them want to go someplace, for the sake of expediency, I'll give up whatever meal I was hoping to have.
Happened to my five-year-old the other day. She wanted tacos. We all wanted to go to Greek food, and she had to go to Greek food.
And, you know, the worst outcome is nobody is going to jam Greek food down anyone else's.
She was really angry, actually, about the Greek food.
Well,
even at five. Sorry.
But it's not. But there's no, you know, there's no force feeding, as in like a. You know,
I was not force feeding.
Right,
no.
A political. You know, democratic political system, which is all about.
Well, I think the difference. Okay, so then here you go. The difference is violence versus nonviolence. When you're in a school, when you're in a Sudbury model school, the decisions are not backed up by, you know, scary men with guns.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, I guess.
So that maybe is why it could work.
And if you're a student in a Sudbury school, I mean, you are kind of, you know, giving your consent to that process. My only concern is that because a sort of democratic system for the school environment might work, that scales up in their minds. They see that scaling up to the whole society, that like, oh, democracy, it's good for, you know, 51% of people to impose their will on 49% of people and take turns doing that because it works so well in my school of 36 kids.
Interesting. Yeah, that's true. That's interesting. Although, is that a better option than, say, at my school, where, you know, it's kind of coming from the board of trustees, even. I mean, the rules of the, I mean, yeah, okay, the teacher's there with the kids and they're there every day and we're not. But, I mean, we are, the board of trustees is technically the policy maker of the school. I mean, isn't the democratic model of the Sudbury School improvement on that? I mean,
my thing would be that if somebody else's will is being imposed on somebody, it could be a king, a board of trustees, or the majority of people. But at the end, you know, it all feels the same way to the recipient.
Some people will debate, though, whether or not a child can always make decisions. You know, with as much because of their lack of experience.
Yeah, perhaps. Especially with the age group that you're talking about, where it's, you know, it's fair to say that there are a number of concerns. I've talked about this several times recently, too, that, you know, I guess people wanted me to try and establish some kind of arbitrary threshold that a child crosses where they can be, you know, sort of self-directed, where nobody can argue that somebody who's 2 or 3 years old needs a fair amount of guidance and probably some pretty regular intervention from
possibly just to save their life.
Exactly.
Perhaps,
so,
times. Yeah.
So what seems to be kind of a gray area is where that change really occurs. And you know, the best answer that I could give them was that enlightened parents or enlightened educators, if they're enlightened, if they're aware of this, then they're constantly watching that child's progress, that child's development, cognizant of the idea that, you know, sooner or later they need to sort of loosen up the restrictions.
Well, and actually, my experience, again, being a parent and a teacher, is it's so child-centric. It so depends on the particular child. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't necessarily have to be direction. You know, like I would rather think of it more as supervision. You know what I mean? Like I don't need to always direct a child, but I may need to always keep an eye on them.
Right, yeah.
You know? And so I think it depends on the particular child, the level of that supervision that they need, or how much of a guide, how much of a mentor, how much of a, you know, do they need is, I think, more dependent on the personality rather than the age. Definitely.
Yeah, and you probably, with the age group that you have in your school, you probably see a significant amount of variance, you know, with that as well. That different students have different needs, and, you know, the parents who, you know, spend the most time with the children might also have some expectations of the people who are, I guess, in charge of the school for guidance or giving some direction. Is that fair to say?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, the only way, particularly in a small school environment, I mean, we can't even in this environment, which is really fun, I think, fun challenge for the teacher. We can't even group the kids if we wanted to, you know, particularly gifted kids because their development is so asynchronous. It's totally individualized based on that specific child. I mean, that's the only way that it's possible in this school. And in my mind, really the only way that it makes sense in education in general.
Right. Right. And that was, I think, one of the questions that I was starting to ask myself. And I guess, you know, from what I've looked at as far as what you're doing, I guess the answer is yes, it is possible. And certainly, I really have to say that it's necessary as, again, a transition. But a question that I've been asking myself over, you know, the last year as I was kind of, you know, thinking about what I had done in the past career-wise and what I wanted to do in the future is, can some kind of learning in a building work, or is the building, is the grouping necessary? And you know, right now I think that it's so important to remember. I always forget, and I always like kind of wind up with my head in the clouds about where I want to go, which, you know, I'm very determined, and I really think that I in my lifetime I would really like to see this society, if not, you know, even the larger world, get there as far as what is considered.
It's very, very ambitious.
It's extraordinarily ambitious. But I need to remember, too, that like where we are now and the gradual process of transition. So that's one of the reasons why I saw what you were doing, and really even to the Sudbury model as being so valuable.
Well, and I think that the building, like you said, can learning, sorry, I had to cut you off, can learning in a building work? And I think that you're assuming that the building is taking on these constraints. It's creating constraints in your mind. And I think that it's important to remember that in some instances, the building doesn't need to be constraints.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if all the people that happen to be in the building are thinking outside of the box, then the building is not a constraint. And of course, learning can happen anywhere.
Yeah, yeah. And right? I think that's right? The thing.
And a library is a building.
And the building is there. Maybe that's, I guess maybe that was kind of what I was driving at, is that the building is there. Well, you know, for a number of reasons, obviously, but part of the environment or the institution itself is that inside, you're doing something that I think a lot of people who like this show or who understand unschooling or the what would we call it?
Autodidactic is being self-taught. I love that.
Right. I was going to try and use it as a noun. The institution of being an autodidact.
That's how you would say it. Yeah, you would say it. You could say it that
That's kind of sloppy. I wish there was a better way. But, you know, I think a lot of people would go into the school and they'd be very satisfied and they'd be very, you know, pleased with what's going on inside it. And, you know, Sudbury as well. But the building is there, I guess, for
You really are demonizing this building.
No, I'm saying that the building is essential. The building is that parents need the building, I guess, is what
I think you're right.
If the building is representative of an institution, of a school, of an organization, the parents, the people who would send their children there, back to what we said originally, people are willing to invest in something, not just financially, but emotionally, as far as their beliefs are concerned, as far as their trust in you is concerned, if it already exists, if it's not an abstract idea. So, you know, you've taken a philosophy of education that I'm very, very supportive of, and you've made it accessible to people who otherwise would not understand it. I think that that's what I'm trying to say.
Thank you. It's been really fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's been really an amazing road. And funny, I'm going to promote my cause for just a minute, sure, because again, on my phone, I just got another donation. I'm having a little fundraising drive this week. We got a new location. And so we need to fill it with furniture, and we could use some money to buy some supplies. So my website is scholarsacademynh.org. And on there, there's just a little chip in where people can click how to help, and then they can make a contribution to us. And, you know, we are structured as a nonprofit. It's tax deductible. Although more importantly, I think for your listeners, we've created a non-government solution to education right here in New Hampshire, and I hope that your listeners will help us.
Absolutely, and we'll make sure we mention it again at the end when we wrap this up. As far as that phrase you just used, non-government solution, I think that that would be something that's worth exploring together here for a while, because the thrust of this show for me was to really point out the fact that we are aware that there needs to be some process of transition from, you know, the status quo or the way it is, or what people mistakenly call education today, to where I think we would both ultimately like to see more and more and more people get to. So you and I were both at the Liberty Forum, and we attended a sort of seminar put on by Alan Schaefer from the Alliance for the Separation of School and State. And it seemed like he was trying to craft an idea of bringing parents together in a community and getting them to invest in a school. Did you kind of get the sense that that was?
I did. I thought that what he was explaining was basically what I was doing, but then maybe on a larger scale. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, seeing it work, I think on a local scale, but on a larger scale, like maybe incorporating the older students as well into a more, God, I hate to use community run, because I don't think that's what he was saying. That's like a terrible sounding phrase.
Well, but I like to think of it in terms of families,
yeah,
which helps me to keep it in perspective. Because honestly, working with these parents that I've been working with, parents have definitive opinions about their children's education. And so I think that in my opinion, I would move in that direction towards the parents of the children who are being educated as the, you know, source of, you know, or calling them the community. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? You know, rather now we have our schools set up so that it's very top down, and the information that the teachers might be teaching, it doesn't come from the parents at all.
Right.
And so I think that for me, I can see that as a tangible example of a place where the parents are the decision makers, so to speak, or the leaders, I guess, as a transitional stage. Does that make sense?
Yeah, or
I mean, I'm not talking about PTO though. I'm talking about the kind of role that I have where, you know, can really drive the school, you know, and maybe it's a scale issue that when you get into larger groups, it's harder to have that, closer feel. Mm-hmm. But I mean, philosophically, I think parents should be, you know, if their children are in the school, the parents should be in charge, no question, to me.
If this students are in a school, yeah, I think the parents should certainly have some kind of, you know, decision-making ability in that school. I absolutely agree with that. It's almost like it's difficult in this sort of foggy middle of where we are and where we want to go to even find, like, the right ways to talk about this. I think it's weird, isn't it? Do you know what I mean?
I think, I mean, if you're talking about like a 100-year plan of having schools be individualized for each kid and have them be on an unschooling model and have them be responsive to children, you know, as individuals, that, I mean, that's tangible to me. But the question is, the intangible part is, you know, are there steps to get there? And I, you know, I mean, I'm not really sure what the steps are. I mean, I know what I can do to solve my problem on a very small scale as an individual and as a parent. If I have these children and I want them to be in an environment that is responsive to them, more like an unschooling model where they're following their interests and they're excited about learning, then I have to take responsibility for that and honestly do as I've done, which is create that model for them. So I guess in some respects, it comes down to personal responsibility too, which again is another entirely, you know, philosophical discussion. But I mean, as a parent, you know, I feel like this is my job,
right,
in some ways, to take responsibility for my children's education. And if I need a building, quote unquote, or a, you know, then I should, or an institution, then I should be active in creating that. And so our society as a whole has moved further and further away from that, I think. And I feel like that's an information war,
right,
perhaps, too.
And I think my approach, what I've realized that I'm, you know, pretty decent at is, you know, putting these ideas out there in a way that I think people would be accessible for most young people. And, you know, giving them the sort of the background of education and kind of probing a little bit into the things that they're being taught, you know, explicitly, maybe related to the civics or the government or history.
A funny tidbit is so many teachers and adults don't like working with teenagers. And I actually am completely the opposite. If that gives you any indication of where I'm coming from. I love an individual that's thinking for themselves. And I find that age group to just be fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really my target. And my thing is, you know, putting all of this stuff out there. But then really, so far, I've hesitated to even give any concrete advice or direction. It's like, you know, here's the information.
Why have you hesitated?
Well, because, you know, here's the information. Please think about it carefully before you do anything with it. I mean, obviously, there's a lot at stake for a 16 or 17 year old. And it's kind of, I really have put it on the individual to make a decision about how the information will be used.
As of course you should, because telling people what to do never works anyway.
So that being said too, I guess being so focused on the individual, which I think is important, and that's probably where I will continue to focus. It's also kind of led to me overlooking the fact that there is a sort of, there is a value in having people organized. So I thought, I mean, you and I talked right after Alan Schaefer's presentation at the New Hampshire Liberty Forum, and, you know, I think I said, well, boy, I can't believe with all the thought and energy and time that I've put into this this whole pursuit that I've never even really considered the process of transition from here to there, like I expect.
Right, and I chuckle.
Yeah, I think
because I'm entrenched in it.
Right, and I just thought that was kind of an amazing realization that yes, I want to be putting the message out in a broad and general way and encouraging people to make their own decisions with this information. And, you know, I don't think in terms of, you know, a 2-decade or a 4-decade or a 1-century plan from here to there. I kind of have realized, you know, my niche is maybe to communicate this stuff and to facilitate maybe a little bit of a forum or a discussion or take suggestions. But I would in no way try to position myself or anyone who's involved in what we're doing at SchoolSucksProject.com as somebody who can deliver a clear plan for the future of education in America. I think that very quickly you start to sound like an insane person, you know, if you think you could do something on such a large scale. Alan knows that he can't do that, and, you know, people like Sheldon Richman, who's also from the Alliance, who's also worked with the Alliance, the separation of school and state. I mean, John Holt, nobody thought they could do that. So I guess it really, I retreated from the idea of organizations at all. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I really don't see myself as a organizer, mm-hmm. so to speak, as much as I've just become it's almost strange. I've almost just become like a cheerleader. You know, like I've gotten to the point now where I just see myself as I find people and individuals, right? And I am good at seeing what they do well. And so then I can help them to kind of form a group that can work together. And I also encourage people to take a stand for what they believe in. And again, whether or not I agree with it, it doesn't matter. But that philosophy of encouraging people to take a stand for what they believe in and then kind of probing them on to action. Mm-hmm. I mean, philosophically is really where I'm coming from. So I'm not necessarily working on a grand plan.
Right.
It's more just exciting day to day to have an amazing project where I'm encouraging these individuals to do this amazing work and that it's benefiting, you know, the children who then also get to be individuals doing amazing work.
Right. Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
Although I appreciate the philosophical discussion about change in education, because I think that helps people to understand where we are right now. You know, people that say read a book about homeschooling learn so much more about just education and children than they knew before. And I think that's really important. So, you know, your discussion about quote unquote school sucks, I think is really important because it's sharing information with people about the way, for example, I know some teenagers and the way they feel when they're in school at times can be very oppressed. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't encourage learning. And so I think, yes, we have a long way to go, but it's important to understand that most of our students are not in an optimal situation. And once we understand that, like you share that information with people, and that's really important. Once we understand that, then we can see a bigger picture and begin to facilitate change, even if it's on such a small scale as encouraging 10 parents to stand up for their kids and start a school.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, and I think, too, is right now, you know, our environment that we live in and the memes that so many people just accept as normal and, you know, even in many cases preferable is just built on, you know, so many layers of bad and destructive philosophy that are not – philosophy is not even the right word, ideology that needed to come in and do repairs or re-rationalize the idea that, you know, just the authoritarian structure that people have tolerated for so long.
Correct. Direct instruction. So many people think direct instruction is the right way to
exactly.
teach.
Absolutely. And like the drilling down you would have to do to just say, because it's very easy to have a somewhat meaningless debate with somebody about direct instruction and, you know, more of a student-centered model in a classroom. But still, you're standing on so many layers of bad ideology that have been built up to even get to this point where we are today.
Well, for example, my discussion with people about the forest versus the trees. Mm-hmm. When you have a subject-driven curriculum, you're teaching the trees.
Right.
But it's so much easier to learn if you're discussing the forest, you know, if you're teaching or working with students in a way that integrates the topics. And just to me, that's 101. That's basic, basic. But to so many people, that's a revolutionary idea in quote unquote education theory or pedagogy.
I taught, I totally agree with what you're saying. What you're saying as a former history teacher, when you look at.
Oh, by the way, when I have a high school, I'm going to heavily recruit you to teach there. Just be ready for it.
You know, I just taught an SAT class.
Although, of course, it won't be graded. It will be from ages 12 to 17.
Well, I would certainly, I would. I don't think I could work in a graded school either. But, it was funny. I didn't even mention this on my show yet. I just finished teaching a 4-week SAT class at Portsmouth High School it was actually the largest class that I ever taught. I think it had 13 kids in it. And, you know, when I worked in private schools, the classes were always smaller than that, maybe like 10 or 11. And, it was just such an interesting experience. It was the first time that I had been in front of a classroom like that in years, like almost 4 years since I left, private education. It's kind of interesting to do that, and it was kind of scary because I remembered why, like when I was in graduate school and trying to shape my education philosophy before I stumbled across like Holt and Gatto and Kozel and those guys, I was very much like a top-down, be the dynamic teacher that people want to listen to kind of guy, because I thought I had all these great, like, you know, Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn type stories about history that was just going to completely shatter everybody's illusions. And, you know, I wanted to be the sage on the stage. That was my philosophy about education 8 years ago. I hate to say it, but as I'm standing up in front of this room, in front of all these kids, and, you know, they're laughing and I'm showing them things and they're like, wow, I never would have even thought of that. It's kind of like I could see how people, not that that's okay at all, but I could see how people get addicted to that kind of.
It is okay in some veins, though, if you think about it. For example, I direct a children's musical theater production every year. And to do it, there's about 50 children in it. And we spend a lot of time sitting in a circle, chatting and discussing kind of what we're going to do. But there also are times when I have to say, okay, you're moving from here to here and you're moving from there to there. And I do put on a little show and do my kind of clowny act to keep them engaged. You know, so they want to be there. It's a choice. But there is time that I do have to give direct, instruction. So
yeah, you know, it was interesting.
And that's okay in that environment because that it works and they're choosing to be there. They're asking for the direct instruction. So
yeah. And I mean, that helps me too, is that this class was all voluntary. I mean, these were people who signed up for it. They wanted to do it. And, you know, there was this one, I think in the third week, there was this situation about an hour and a half into the class. And I told everybody, you know, if you want to get up and leave, if you get restless, go ahead. That's fine. You don't even have to, like, people were raising their hands. I'm like, ooh.
I know.
Gross.
That's hard.
Just go.
I do the same thing when I teach. Right. I'm like, if you need to go, you just need to go.
Right. Like, can I go to the bathroom?
Like, please don't ask me if you can go to the bathroom.
Yeah. I was like, wow, this is amazing. So, but anyway, right. I was, going over something. I think we were talking about essay writing or something. And for some reason, this, one kid just turns around and starts having a conversation with this other kid. And I'm watching it. I'm like, oh, what the hell do I do? Cause like, mm-hmm. you know, five, six.
I do sometimes ask that I not, you know, be interrupted. Like, cause that is rudeness.
Yeah, yeah.
In any environment when someone's talking, you shouldn't speak over them or have a side conversation. So I might use that as a sharing social graces opportunity as a teacher.
Yeah.
You know?
So yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But it was this weird kind of confronting, awkward moment for me where it had been a good 6 years since I had done anything with anybody that would be considered like discipline. And
right,
certainly,
right. It's not discipline to me. It's teaching.
Right.
Go ahead. Continue.
But it was that kind of from my experience as a teacher, it was like a discipline moment.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Oh no, someone's talking in the back of the classroom.
Right. So it's like,
yes.
Oh, what do I do? So I just stop talking for a second.
Yeah.
And
there.
He turns around and he's like, oh, I'm sorry.
Good for him. That's the appropriate response.
I was like, wow, what a
teenagers. I'm telling you, they know. They
know. So,
you know,
it was, a neat experience to get back in front of
I did that the other day in an area outside of one of the schools in my town where there were some kids swearing, teenagers swearing. And I just said to them, hey, guys, I have little kids here. You know, can you just watch your language? And they totally looked to me and said, you know, I'm sorry. Sorry. Yeah, we will. You know, I mean, they know. You know, kids are not, I feel like in our society, we don't value the individual enough. And I think a teenager is definitely an individual that knows, you know, what's going on. That's for sure.
Well, especially when they all get this message, too, that if they are an individual, they're defective. If they can't sit rank and file in a room of 30 other people for whatever the specified period of time is during whatever the specified teacher decided topic of discussion is, if they happen to get restless or frustrated or wander off mentally during that, they're defective. I mean, that's cause for drugging somebody. It's clearly like, you know, as far as the school psychologist or guidance department is, that's a serious problem as far as they're concerned.
Isn't that interesting? Because as an adult, if I was to go take a class and I enrolled in the class voluntarily and I'm paying the teacher to teach me what I want to know from the class, and I found the class to be boring and not worth my time, and I left the class, then that would be totally within my right as an adult to just get up and be like, okay, I know I paid for this and all, but it's really not worth my time, so I'm going to go and work on something else.
Right, right.
I mean, that would make perfect sense as an adult for me to do that type of thing. I might actually speak to the person and say, look, I paid the tuition for this class, and I'm just finding it to be a total bore.
Right.
And I just, can you give me my money back, actually?
Right, but that's not even on the table. And I
know some good students who really, like National Honor Society students. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they even find it very difficult. Mm-hmm.
But I even felt like when I would do some Q&A during the class that there was this certain sense. I mean, it was subtle. It wasn't like totally visible, and it wasn't everybody, but even like this sense, this slight sense of shame in needing to ask a question or in not understanding something or requiring something different that everybody else in the group is not requiring. And I would stop every 5 minutes of the class and I would say, who's got a question? Does anyone have any questions? Does anybody want to talk about any of this stuff? And you know, I just said several times, I said, you know, if you even have like a thought, please put it out there. Because somebody else will probably be glad that you did, and I really would like to hear what you guys think, and I love to get feedback, and, you know, if you, question anything that I'm saying, or if you disagree, it's like...
Yeah, I have to remember, though, too, that if we're talking about, say, a high school environment, that it's very peer-driven.
Yes, exactly.
And that same aged grouping creates a lot of competition. Mm-hmm. Right? We know that. You and I do education theory-wise. Not everyone knows that, but I can tell them that same-aged grouping creates competition, and it creates a weird culture that's not natural. And so I can imagine that a group of kids that are all the same age in this environment would have difficulty because of that feeling of competition and the peer I don't want to call it peer pressure because that's such an overused word, but that Lord of the Flies feeling, so to speak, they might have difficulty having a good intellectual conversation about something like, you know, history or how they're going to write an essay.
Yeah, I agree. I really felt like their expectation was that I would do most of the talking. I would do most of the talking, and it doesn't mean there wasn't any questions or there wasn't any feedback. And I was certainly grateful when it came, but I really would have liked the whole experience to be more interactive than it was.
I would encourage you to put your chairs in a circle. Your desks and or the seats of the kids, just for good measure.
Well, yeah, they were in rows, and I remember I walked into the building.
Yeah, you got to change the arrangement of the room.
Yeah, I mean it's probably $5-6 million of taxpayer money that was shoveled into this school, and you know it's a modern school, probably built in the last 10 years. But you walk in there, and it's just instantly the most stale, empty, and cold feeling place. and you go into the classroom, and they have all these things that were like on my wish list when I was a teacher in a private school where, you know, people had,
overhead projector.
Yeah, like where people had to, like, so I had to, I remember like downloading YouTube videos when YouTube, like YouTube was brand new when I was leaving teaching, and I was like, oh, this is the greatest thing ever, and I would go out and buy DVDs and, you know, CDs and make these CDs and play them on the, you know, the 27-inch old tube TV.
Your TV on the cart. Yeah, on the cart.
On the cart.
Wheelie cart.
And just thinking, like, I remember, like, going into schools and seeing, like, these smart boards and these sliding dry erase boards and projectors and new Macs everywhere and just saying, oh, you know, if only. But it's not making
– It's way more fun, let me just tell you, to teach outdoors.
Yeah.
I know, revolutionary idea. Yep. But you should put your chairs and the desks in a circle, if nothing else, just for me.
Oh, yeah, well, if I get the chance to do this again, I think that might have been like a one-time thing. Usually our classes are pretty small. I like to keep them around, you know, five or six kids just to make sure we can, you know, put the individual attention where it needs to go for the SAT. You know, it's fast and it's furious. We try to do the whole thing in like 10 hours and...
Oh, man.
You know, just like I'd rather have them do the work on their own. Like, the you know, the other companies, they'll have the kids sit there and, like, do the work in the class while their parents are paying them to sit there and do work that they could be doing at home.
Oh.
So we try to cut out so we can lower our costs a little bit. But, you know, I do. I 13 was a big group for that. But I liked having a class like that. But I really think that I've resigned myself to I have to settle for – you know, being a speaker at UConn or being a speaker at a Liberty Forum or some other event, if I just want to have a whole room full of people listening to me, right? Because education, if I, you know, if I...
You can direct children's musical theater.
Right,
that's
right.
Fun.
But as much as I like...
Try facilitating a group of 40 elementary school children in a conversation. It's really interesting.
And as much as I like the idea of, you know, being a... in front of people and talking and sharing information and making people laugh, school just wasn't the place. And I've realized
you could do stand-up comedy.
Stand-up comedy, or I could combine like stand-up comedy and teaching into a podcast.
That would be very interesting.
Try that.
You could be like, okay, everyone, now move your chair into the circle.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot so far. One thing that I think we should point out is a couple, because we are in, you know, despite the good work that you're doing, despite the good work that a lot of people are doing, most people and, as far as what is considered normal and acceptable, it's a pretty dark place for most people right now. And like I said at the beginning of the show, over, you know, 90% of school age children are in the government schools. $600 billion a year is pumped into public education. No questions asked. There's no real suggestion box and there's no refunds. And that's, you know, that's passing right now as education. So we talked about what you're doing and we talked a little bit about the
it is really possible, just so you know, too, to do it for much less.
Well, that's what I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, too, because people love to talk about – people are pragmatists for the most part, even though I think that that's a very dangerous philosophy. People want to talk about numbers and they want to talk about effects.
Sure.
And, you know, they'd like, why do you talk, Brett, all about these principles and these underlying ideas? We like effects. We like numbers. We like charts.
I do some grant writing, and so I do understand that substantiating or vice versa, quantifying the end result in numbers. Mm-hmm. I get that. It's really not my favorite thing to do, but I mean, I can tell you that a small private school is significantly less expensive to run than a large school. It may be just the scale. It might also be the fact that the people that are paying the tuition are running the school. And so they want to keep their tuition as low as possible so they can afford it. But they also want as much as possible for their dollar. And so it's kind of an entirely different perspective when you're looking at budgets. Mm-hmm. You know, the budget of Scholars Academy has been put together and approved by the same parents whose children go there. So the priorities are right. You know, our biggest expense is payroll.
Right.
you know, it's the people that teach. And then our next biggest expense is our, you know, facility, our space. So, I mean, it depends on just if the parents wanted to pay more for the education because they wanted to pay more for the teacher, then they might choose to do that. But, I mean, on a smaller scale, I mean, our tuition this year was $7,500. And next year, I think it's going to be $8,000. And our operation is pretty much break even. I mean, we take in the amount of dollars that we have per student and then we, you know, spend it because we would buy microscopes or something if we had extra money,
right, right.
You know?
Yeah, I remember the shoestring. That's kind of where I was going with my, you know, going into Portsmouth High School and seeing all the bells and whistles that are being used to not educate people, and kind of.
Well, it makes you have to be much more innovative too, and I think that's a much that's more fun in education.
Yeah, absolutely, anyway. Absolutely, and that was my experience too. That it was frustrating to go from where I worked back in the private school days into a public school and see just the amount of waste that, you know, these $800, $900 per projectors were just gathering dust because teachers weren't using them. And when they did fire up the projector and pull down the screen, it was to show the kids a video about what an awesome guy Woodrow Wilson was. So, you know, that sucks. that's unfortunate. But and just thinking about the kind, but, you know, I was able to, I worked hard in my non-classroom hours when I was a teacher to, you know, bring in interesting things. And you're right. Very innovative. So you're saying, kind of like what we're saying here, is that education might not need to give everybody an education. And that's, let me take that phrasing back because I didn't like that at all.
Please, I almost just vomited on my keyboard. Jeez. I mean, my God, think about who you're talking to here.
Everybody to, how do we want to phrase? See, this is like from where we are to where we want to go. How do you even, what's the
point? What are you talking about? Tell me what you're talking about. You're talking about that to get every kid an education thing?
Yeah, and I think I'm borrowing.
But so that they can be in an environment that's not oppressive.
Might not need to cost $600 billion a year. Might not need to cost more than $500 billion a year to do.
Well, I know some homeschoolers that it doesn't really cost them that much at all.
Right.
I mean, so it just, I think that I have a tendency to look at, you know, just like I do in my life, I make choices, of course, every day. What kind of car am I going to drive? You know what I mean? Does it need to be a fancy dancy car or no? How about I get the small car that gets really good gas mileage? You know, I mean, you make choices, and I guess in schools, it makes sense to make those same choices or for the children to drive those choices, so to speak. I mean, if you really, it would be nice, for example, I have all these hardwood floors at the Scholars Academy, mm-hmm. right? And I can imagine that it probably would be nice to have a carpet. Like an area rug, mm-hmm. like a big one.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
See, so there are things that might be a choice, but that I might consider worth spending my money on. And someone might say, okay, well, that's the same as the projectors at Portsmouth High School. You don't need a carpet. No, I don't need a carpet, but, you know, so I think that, again, if you're looking at education based on families and kids, mm-hmm. then a carpet makes sense.
Right.
If you're looking at education on the kind of the way we're doing it now, which is so separate from the kids and the families, then the projector doesn't make sense.
Right. I think about this as well, that with all that money that's going into that for the amount of choice, like we're also talking about people having input, you know, on the student level and on the parent level into their education. I'd like to remind people the amount of effort, of time and energy and frustration that would need to be exerted by a parent to change one tiny thing about one class during 1 year of their child's entire education. My father, when I was in elementary school, he was the chairman of the school board. He learned his lesson, you know, about...
I did learn my lesson, too, which is why I'm doing this
right,
now.
Yeah.
Instead of fighting with a public school.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, he was just too radical for the school district. He made outlandish suggestions like the teachers should be based on their pay should be based on merit or should be based on achievement. That was extremely unpopular.
I actually just wanted my daughter to be able to read at her own
right.
level.
Exactly. Yeah. And now think about
think about the time, and you know, because you probably went through some of this, and you probably fought this fight.
That's how I ended up here, actually.
Right. And I just say that to everybody who's listening, or anybody who might be skeptical, you know, about some of this stuff, is that the PTA meetings, the research, the meetings at the school, the calling the teachers, the talking to guidance counselors, all for one. Maybe the thing you want to change is you want some book added or some book taken away. Right, which is weird that somebody would think that they could have a right to impose what they want on everybody else, but that's the nature of the system. All of the time and energy and effort and frustration that is directed into that tiny little fraction of the child's entire educational experience. Now I would ask them to fast forward to June when they're getting ready to send their child to camp. And how responsive people are. And, you know, I've done this part of it too. Like, how many options there are? Well, you know, we want to do music, or we want to do athletics, or we want some kind of an academic camp, and we want to spend this much, and we don't want this, and we don't need this, but we do need this. And suddenly, for something that would seem comparatively as trivial as summer camp, look at all the options, look at all the possibilities, look at all the choice that suddenly becomes available. Harry Brown used to do this example with a supermarket, right? Like, you don't, there's no PTA meeting you need to go to if the supermarket doesn't have the kind of ice cream you want. You either tell somebody they have it next week, or you go to another supermarket, right? That's the part.
There's a sound bite of me on a local radio station, or there was years ago, with a quote like that, saying, you know, we have all these choices in laundry detergent and toilet paper, but yeah. Only one choice, you know?
On something that is so important. And we're also kind of, while there is no choice, there also is in so many ways.
Well, there is a choice, actually. I mean, you can withdraw your child, which is what I did. You can withdraw your child from whatever school that they're in, really, at any time. You know, and that's it.
Well, how do you, like,
you walk into the store and you say, "I'm sorry, my child is not returning tomorrow." You know.
So how would you present that idea, let's say, to parents, or if students are listening to this show, and that is something that most people unfortunately just consider so impractical, and it's a shame that people think that way, and I really don't think it is that impractical. And of course, there's always the social stigma that surrounds those things. But how would you have that conversation with a parent, let's say, who is?
Well, actually, in my parent support group in Manchester, that comes up all the time, mm-hmm. because there's parents of kids. The kids are in public schools, and they're gifted children. They're very bright kids, and they're not being challenged at all. So they become bored and frustrated. Then they don't want to go to school. And then they begin giving the parents, you know, every morning a difficult time going to school. And then it sometimes snowballs into behavior problems at school. And so in many instances, especially before I created Scholars Academy, right before we got together and did this, my suggestion was just withdraw your child. Withdraw your child tomorrow. You know?
And what kind of feedback would you get? I mean, what kind of resistance would you get?
In some instances, it made total sense to people.
Mm-hmm.
It made total sense. But again, these were our parents that are at the end of their rope. And so when you get to that point, you know you're there. When your child is crying every morning because they don't want to go to school, you know that you're there. And the relationship that you have with the individual that is your child is much more important than enforcing the mandatory attendance, you know, laws. And it's so easy. I mean, in New Hampshire, it's so easy to be a homeschooler. It's just simple, you know, and I think also that there are, you know, Scholars Academy, yes, being one, but there are other schools that are just much better alternatives, you know, for so many children that, you know, particularly kids that are showing an aversion to going to school.
Yeah.
Oh, that I mean, definitely. I mean, if you have a child that's happy at school and they're having a good time and they enjoy their friends and they enjoy what they're doing there, then that's one thing. But if you have a child who is showing an aversion or who it's causing them emotional distress, I mean, come on.
Right.
That's a no-brainer to me.
And I always,
to me, that's a no-brainer.
And I always say too, when you know, I just had a conversation not too long ago with a recent graduate who said that, you know, he really
found, you know, his educational experience to be satisfying and helpful and rewarding. And I, you know, I asked him, his, you know, public education experience. And I asked him, you know, compared to what?
Well, that's true. And that's where you and I come from. But also you have to remember that parents and kids, you know, they kind of go through life day to day, you know, and when day to day something is working, then, you know, okay, you and I, Brett, can facilitate change on a greater scale because we see it. But for them, it's not on their radar.
Yeah.
You know, but if you're in a situation where you are experiencing distress, I mean, Bill Gates did a study on dropouts from public high schools. And it was really interesting because I have been studying gifted ed, you know, for a few years, obviously on my own. But it was really interesting because I think either the number was 40% or 60%. I'm sorry, I don't have photographic memory, but of students that dropped out of school found it actually boring.
Right.
They dropped out. Like one of their primary reasons was that it was boring. And those are probably, you know, the very bright kids that are causing a total ruckus and getting into trouble all the time. And I mean, if a person is in that kind of situation and it's not satisfying for them, then I mean, why would you stay?
Yeah. And that's the real,
why would you continue to do that? I mean, yes, some people are very entrenched and they believe that that traditional education system works. And so they have a tendency to stay longer than is maybe healthy. But if it's not working for the child or the parent or the individual, whomever, then, I mean, would you stay at a job that was where you were being injured,
right,
or you were crying every morning when you drove there because it was so awful?
Yeah, and I really think
of
that, too, with school, it's just such a, you know, even though people forget, and even though, well, people don't forget, people don't even know that the institution of government-run or publicly subsidized schooling was so controversial when people first tried to institute it, and it was met with so much resistance.
I thought that was really interesting when I learned that.
It was met with so much resistance in so many places for so many reasons. But within a century, it's just become such a, you know, an ingrained institution that you're right. If the non-squeaky wheel does not need any grease as far as most people are concerned, you know, the grease being their attention or their thought or their consideration in this case, that their kid leaves at 7:30 in the morning. They can go to work. Their kid comes home at 3:00. They're given a couple hours of things to do at night to keep them busy. And that pretty much works pretty well with their professional schedule. And they're not coming home with physical bruises for the most part, most of the time. And, you know, maybe the school can even offer them a few things to do related to some of their athletic interests or musical interests or whatever. So
there are also people, just so you know, that I know who have homeschooled, individual people, teenagers, who have homeschooled and then choose to go to school, but they have it in perspective. I think that's kind of an interesting dichotomy.
And that's what's important for me, too, because obviously, like I said, I'm not big on real concrete advice. So I can't say, all right, you've heard 35 episodes of my show, time to drop out of school, right? Like, I don't want to say that to somebody. And then I wouldn't say that to somebody because that's not a decision that I'm qualified to make.
Although I have to admit, I have told parents of teenagers that they should take their teenagers out of the school. It depends on the kid,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, I've suggested it once before as a tutor. I suggested it to two parents who were crying. The mother was crying to me when she started talking about her son and her daughter's experience at
I've known
school.
Some children also that have been bullied.
And I
feel like those children should be taken out too. They should. I mean, as a parent, if my child was being bullied in school, there is no way I would bring them back the next day.
Right.
There's not enough supervision. You know, the teachers don't seem to be around enough to be able to really be engaged with all the kids. And so that kind of stuff happens. And if I had a child who was a target, forget it. That kid would be out the next day. Bam. Gone. I'd do anything. I don't even care. I would figure it out as far as daytime. You know, like, who's going to watch the kid if I take him out of school? I'll figure it out.
And the other thing, too, is that it's an environment where that bullying is encouraged. There's a cycle of abuse that goes on in those buildings. And
well, that's the Lord of the Flies competitive aged grouping kind of thing.
Well, I think a lot of it comes from like the a lot of the adults in those buildings are bullies as far as like what polite and respectful human interactions are concerned.
Oh, interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
Well, I don't want to pillage too much from the next show because I am kind of working on a new series related to a lot of these ideas. Some of the things that we've talked about or we've touched on in this show. But yeah, I mean, the environment is conducive to that kind of disrespectful and even in many cases, unfortunately, violent behavior. So of course I understand what you're saying that, there are times where the best recommendation, the best recommendation as far as I'm concerned for just about anybody would be to get their kids out of government school. But for somebody who is listening to the show and is 14 to 18 years old, I would say the same thing to them to get yourself out of government school. But I have a real hard time as putting that forward as the concrete recommendation of the show. I can put the information out there, and that's really kind of what I've resigned myself to.
Well, and again, like I said earlier, you can't tell people what to do because they don't really do it anyway. Right. You know, nobody really is not going to listen to you.
Right, and I wouldn't want to tell people what to do, and I certainly
you're a bright guy,
wouldn't assume.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. So, just if we were going to shift for the last few minutes here to some advice, we talked a little bit about frustrated parents, but if you could put forward, you know, a little bit of a vision as far as what you would like to see happen in this transition over the short term, the medium term.
I mean, personally, I love the idea of, you know, like what I've done, which is groups of parents getting together and kind of agreeing on a quote unquote educational foundation for their kids. Mm-hmm. And then creating a small private school. So for example, if you wanted to, for me to draw a plan for you and you're looking at a elementary school that had, 500 children in it, perhaps you might poll the people in the school and say to them, you know, what are your different areas of interest and what kinds of small schools might you be interested mm-hmm. in, right? And then maybe those people would, instead of having this big 500 child school, they might break off into small groups and then have maybe a smaller environment that of their choosing, you know, that works more individualized, you know, for the families and the kids. So there's a little, that's kind of a concrete idea.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you're so right. I just couldn't stress that enough, that concrete ideas and things that are already in motion are what people go for. I think that explains, obviously, the...
Well, and it's easy, really. There's so many people that are unhappy with the public school mm-hmm. that their kids are in. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of people that are happy with their public schools, but there's so many people that are unhappy. If they just get together in a little group... I mean, the difficult thing is sometimes for people is paying. There's a kid that I know of that's in public school that really should be at the Scholars Academy, and I need to raise money so that kid can go to the school, mm-hmm. you know, because the parents can't pay. And so that barrier, the taxes that we pay for the public's big barrier, because people are already paying for those schools, and then I'm asking them to pay tuition on top of that.
Just to go back to something you said a minute ago, is that a lot of parents are happy with the schools. I think in a lot more often than not, and I would say really if they thought about it almost always, that happiness is actually acceptance. It's
fair. So, yes, I agree.
So like when we talk about, you know, making alternatives work, you yeah. can show people something tangible and that people are attracted to that, something they can see, something they can feel, something that they can observe. Well, that kind of explains the, for lack of a better word, success yeah. of the government institution. It's already there. I have to pay for it. All the neighbors' kids go there. It appears to be running. It appears to be functioning. I went there. Dad went there. Grandpa went there.
That's what frustrates yeah. me the most is, well, it was okay for me.
Right. Ugh. Right. So.
Yeah, but you didn't wear a seatbelt. You know what I mean? You know, I'm going to wear my seatbelt. I don't know about you, but just because when you were a kid, you didn't wear your seatbelt doesn't mean I'm not going to buckle up my little kid in the car.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, I know better. Yeah. So I can make a more educated choice. I think it's interesting. Something I've heard that kind of hurts me to my core, actually, is there's a school here in my town where people, say get through. Like, oh, my kid will get, they'll get through it all right.
Yeah.
It's such an oppressive place. And then with the reaction of everybody being, you know, I say, well, have you considered, you know, this or that? And they're like, oh, you know, it's all right. They'll get through it. I'm like, jeez.
Right. Because it builds character. It builds character to have your character destroyed.
What a life.
Yeah.
You know?
It's really, that's really, frustrating. But that's such a typical rationalization too. Well, you know, I'm paying for it. I don't have the time between work and family and finances and everything else going on. I don't have time. If there's a building that's up that the kid can walk into that can occupy his time for 7 hours and that's what everyone else does and I pay for it anyway, then, you know, that's not where my energy or my focus needs to be right now. So really what my project has been, and I believe that, it's probably where my energy is going to go is, you know, finding, you know, hopefully interesting and engaging ways to raise awareness about the reality of the government school system and open up a forum to alternatives. But I do anticipate that, you know, the first question that has ever been asked of me when I start voicing my opinions about the government system is, well, what would you do? How would you run a system for how what would you replace it with? You know, like asking me to right. be a central, the central planner trap. If you can't,
you could just give him my number. Just give him my number. They'll, by the time I'm done with them, they'll be like, right, and I'm not calling her again.
But what I always point out, and what the people who love and worship central planners, and people who say that they can solve all their problems if they check a box next to their name, those kinds of people don't accept the idea that maybe the one thing needs to be replaced with 100,000 different things.
Of course it does, because aren't there 100,000 different people?
Oh, at the very...
Who all operate differently and who all have different opinions and needs and wants, and doesn't that make the most sense?
And one of those 100,000 things, just one, even though it's such an important one, could be unschooling, which breaks down into however many tens of millions of people make that their own thing, and everybody would make it something different. And that's learning, right? That's kind of replacing this idea of education or schooling with learning. So,
although not all schools suck.
Absolutely, I agree. And in closing, can you go through your information
yes.
again, and just please let people know what you're needing right now, because we do have a lot of, I mean, I'm in Manchester, you're in Manchester, and I do have a lot of listeners in the New Hampshire area. So if you could go through all that again, that would be great.
Okay, great. The website, again, is scholarsacademynh.org. We're going to move to our new location on Saturday morning. If people want to help us move, there's a Facebook event set up for it so they can help us move. I've been fundraising all week to pay for our new location, to fit up the new location. We're going to be working on a list soon of actual materials that we need, furniture and whatnot. But if somebody really could make a cash donation at scholarsacademynh.org right now, that really is the best possible thing that they could do to help us.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, it has been a pleasure to have you on the show. I'm sure it will not be the last time, because I think we said we'd do an hour. We're an hour and 40 minutes in. There's no shortage of things for you and I to talk about. And I definitely look forward to having you on, Kate, again in the future to get an update on both the Scholars Academy, but also to wow, there's a lot of things we could talk about.
It's really fun. Yes. I'm glad that I met you at the Liberty Forum.
Absolutely.
Right? Yes.
Likewise. So thank you very much, and good luck, and we will talk again soon.
Thank you so much.